The headlines: United States says significant restrictions on Taiwan access to the international financial system remains in place. Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga announces his resignation after just a year in office amid criticism of his government's response to the pandemic. A Palestinian told a funeral for a 26-year-old man who succumbed to injuries sustained by Israeli live fire during an anti-siege protest in the Gaza Strip. Hello and welcome, everybody. The U.S. Treasury Department says Washington has not reduced sanctions pressure on Taliban leaders. The Treasury says significant restrictions on Taliban access to the international financial system remains in place. Experts believe, in line with that policy, billions in Afghan assets parked in the U.S. will remain frozen for months. Last month, the International Monetary Fund blocked the Taliban from accessing some $440 million in new emergency reserves. Humanitarian groups have warned that the cost may be the collapse of Afghanistan's economy. Food and fuel prices are already soaring there amid a shortage of cash, partly triggered by a halt in dollar shipments. Political commentator Inner Tangen says the Afghan assets frozen in the U.S. have become a source of leverage for Washington.
There are a number of issues that have to be considered. One is legitimacy. I mean, there has not been a formal handover of power. There needs to be recognition. These are the kind of bureaucratic details that the U.S. Intends to use as a, basically, as a way of kind of putting more pressure on the Taliban. Remember, if it was the Afghan government, in theory, Ghani is still the president. He could have tried to grab some of that cash. I don't think the U.S. would have let him, but that's in theory where things are. But it comes down to two points, leverage and then possible trying to create destabilization in the area. And leverage, I mean, the U.S., you know, Biden has promised that he's going to bring home more Americans, more Afghans, etc. I think this is going to be one of their main pressure points, is this financial side. The other thing is, if the U.S. isn't happy, it'll be quite obvious that they will just withhold the money entirely. In that case, it causes a huge economic and humanitarian catastrophe in the area that the neighbors, Russia, China, and the surrounding neighbors in the stands will have to deal with.
The United Nations has resumed its humanitarian flights to northern and southern Afghanistan more than 2 weeks after the Taliban takeover. A UN spokesperson says the flights will enable scores of humanitarian organizations to continue life-saving activities in Afghanistan. The current flights link Pakistan's capital with the city of Mazar-e-Sharif in northern Afghanistan and Kandahar in the south. Three flights have already landed in Mazar-e-Sharif this week. The UN says efforts are underway to launch more flights and to more destinations. It says work is also underway to transport non-food items such as medical supplies. The UN has previously warned of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan, where half of the population depends on aid. Taliban sources say the group's co-founder and head of political office, Mullah Baradar, will lead the new government in Afghanistan. The sources also said Mullah Muhammad Yaqub, the son of late Taliban founder Mullah Omar, will join the government with a senior position. According to the sources, the deputy head of the Taliban's political office, Sher Muhammad Abbas Stanikzai, will take a high-ranking post as well. The Taliban were expected to unveil the new government on Friday, but AFP news agency citing a group spokesman said the announcement has been postponed until Saturday. The Taliban swept to power on August 15th after taking control of Kabul and most of Afghanistan, and has pledged to form an inclusive government and respect human rights and women's freedom within Islamic law. In the EU, foreign policy chief says the bloc will engage with the Taliban in order to support the Afghan people, but it doesn't mean it will recognize the new government there. Josep Borrell made the comment following a meeting of EU foreign ministers in Brussels. He He said the engagement would increase depending on the behavior of a new government in Kabul. The top diplomat, however, laid out some strict conditions for such relations. The conditions include ensuring that Afghanistan will not become a terrorist hub, ensuring the delivery of humanitarian aid, and allowing people to leave the country's borders. Borrell also said EU members have agreed to coordinate with the Taliban and establish a joint presence in Kabul if security conditions are met there. Elsewhere, the Japanese Prime Minister says he will not seek re-election as the head of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party in an election later this month.
Dr. Jichini,
I want to focus on working on COVID-19 measures. So I said I will not run in the LDP election. While I had the schedule to run, thinking about COVID-19 measures and election activities needed an enormous amount of energy. In that situation, I could not do both. I needed to choose one.
Yeah, LDP officials have expressed surprise at the announcement. They, however, said that Suga will continue to serve as the LDP's president until the party-wide election is held on September 29th. The winner of the vote will most probably become the next Japanese premier as the LDP holds the majority. In the lower house, Suga took office as the prime minister last September after Shinzo Abe resigned over ill health. Suga's tenure has been marred by an unpopular COVID response and dwindling public support. South Korea has extended social distancing restrictions to contain COVID ahead of a Thanksgiving holiday that will begin on September 20th. The government says the curbs will run until October the 3rd, with the toughest set for Greater Seoul. Part of the curbs limits holiday gatherings to up to 8 people, provided that at least half have completed vaccination. The government has now speeded up the vaccination program. It plans to fully inoculate half of the population by the end of September. That's to rein in a Delta variant outbreak that began in July. The authorities say they fear a spike in cases from increased movement around the upcoming holidays. Korea's total infections are above 257,000, with more than 2,300 deaths. At least 6 people have been injured in what the authorities have called a terrorist attack in New Zealand's largest city, Auckland.
This afternoon at approximately 2:40 p.m., a violent extremist undertook a terrorist attack on innocent New Zealanders in the Newland Countdown in Auckland.
The Prime Minister said the attacker stabbed the victims in a supermarket and was immediately shot dead by the police. She said the attacker was a Sri Lankan national who had been in New Zealand for 10 years and was known to the police. Ardern called the attack hateful and said the attacker was inspired by the Daesh terrorist group. In March 2019, New Zealand witnessed its worst ever terror attack in Christchurch. There, a white supremacist shot dead more than 50 Muslim worshippers at a mosque. U.S. President Joe Biden has declared an emergency in the state of New York. He has ordered to federal aid to help regional responders tackle the devastation caused by the fading Hurricane Ida. The Department of Homeland Security and Federal Emergency Management Agency are now authorized to coordinate all disaster relief efforts. Biden has already approved an emergency declaration for New Jersey. The states themselves declared state of emergencies on Wednesday, ordering residents to stay home. Ida made landfall in Louisiana on Sunday. It has already killed 46 people in 6 northeastern states, leaving a trail of destruction. Millions have been left without power. Iran has reported more than 561 new coronavirus fatalities, pushing its overall death toll to more than 109,500. Health officials also registered over 27,600 new infections over the past day. The overall caseload has now surpassed 5.8 million. The highly contagious Delta variant is blamed for the rise in both cases and deaths. Officials have tried to accelerate mass vaccinations to curb the deadly virus. That includes importing up to 5 million doses of vaccines every week to help stem the disease. Over 19 million Iranians have received the first dose of the jab, and more than 9 million have been fully vaccinated. Palestinians have laid to rest a man killed by the Israeli fire during an anti-siege protest in the Gaza Strip on Thursday. 26-year-old Ahmad Saleh succumbed to the wounds he sustained in the abdomen near the so-called buffer zone in Gaza. Five others were wounded, including a child who is in critical condition. Israeli forces targeted the protesters who were setting fire to tires and throwing stones. Palestinians have been staging protests in the area since last week to vent anger against the Israeli blockade of Gaza. Their protests have been met by Israeli live fire. Gaza has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. The siege and several Israeli wars have destroyed Gaza's economy. The disputed Kashmir region has lost one of its most prominent pro-independence leaders. Sayed Ali Shah Gilani spent most of his life in the struggle against Indian rule.
Top Kashmiri pro-independence leader Sayed Ali Shah Gilani passed away this week at the age of 92. Gilani was a veteran campaigner against Indian rule. He had been under house arrest for well over a decade after leading several protests. The pro-independence leader, who demanded a referendum on whether Kashmir should remain under the control of New Delhi, spent long spells in jail. The news of his death triggered authorities to beef up security in the area and shut down internet services. Many Kashmiris believe his legacy will live on in the disputed Himalayan region.
He had dedicated his life entirely to the Kashmiri struggle, and he did not bend down even when others, including some political leaders in Pakistan, were willing to compromise. Sayed Ali Shah Gilani refused to do so. So in that sense, his legacy is enormous. He definitely would be missed by the Kashmiri people, especially the youth, although he was 92 years old when he passed away. But he has inspired several generations of Kashmiri youth to continue their struggle.
Kashmir has been a flashpoint between nuclear-armed neighbors, India and Pakistan, for over seven decades now. The two neighbors have fought several wars over the disputed region. As the two rivals dig in their heels, people in Indian-controlled Kashmir face an increasing tough battle for independence. Muslims in the region have long complained of systematic abuse. There are widespread reports of killings, torture, and forced disappearances, and sexual violence by Indian forces in Kashmir. In 2019, after seven decades, India revoked the special status of Kashmir in a bid to control the Muslim-majority region more tightly. The move infuriated Islamabad, which condemned it as a clear violation of the United Nations Security Council resolutions.
Unending belligerence and hostilities between New Delhi and Islamabad have their roots in one of the world's longest-running territorial disputes. India and Pakistan both want Kashmir in full, but currently control it in part. The issue still has the potential to trigger more conflicts, but how did the problem begin in the first place? Let's find out in this next report.
The dispute over Kashmir goes back to 1947. In August that year, the British began quitting colonial India after many decades. Their departure led to the partition of India. The British drew a line on the map, starting an acrimonious rivalry that continues to this day. Majority Muslim provinces of India formed the newly created Pakistan, and majority Hindu provinces remained in India. The ruler of the state of Jammu and Kashmir was given the choice to join India or Pakistan. The resource-rich Jammu and Kashmir is a Muslim-majority state, but its ruler, who was a Hindu, chose to accede to India.
But when it came to Kashmir, which is a predominantly Muslim area and still is, the Hindus basically, or the Indian Congress basically, violated this rule. And at that time, there was a British viceroy, Lord Mountbatten, who was also happened to be the viceroy of India. He connived with the Indian rulers as well as with the Hindu ruler of Kashmir, even though the majority of the population, the overwhelming majority of the population was Muslim, that the British played its dirty role in this.
The events led to the first war between India and Pakistan. The hostilities left over 1,000 Indians and more than 6,000 Pakistani forces dead. By the end of the war in 1948, Indian forces held two-thirds of Kashmir and Pakistan had the smaller northern segment. The two rivals have fought several wars over the region. Indian and Pakistani forces have engaged in numerous cases of deadly clashes across the line of control. Kashmir is widely considered as one of the most militarized and dangerous zones in the world. The UN Security Council has called for a referendum on the status of the region, but that has never happened. The mountainous Himalayan region has enormous strategic importance. The geopolitical ambitions of India and Pakistan seem to be playing a major role in prolonging the deadlock and suffering of Kashmiris.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The unique jihad of Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and condolences to you on a doleful day. The 25th of Muharram is the day on which the survivor of the heart-rending tragedy of Karbala, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, attained martyrdom because of a fatal dose of poisoning in the year 95 AH, 34 years after the tragic martyrdom of his father, Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Before we present you a feature on the great-grandson and fourth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, here is a passage worth contemplating upon. Woe to you, O son of Adam! You're negligent, but not neglected. Your death is a hastiest to you. It is approaching you with sure steps. It is targeting you and is about to hit you, and you will soon take your age in full. The angel of death seizes your soul, and you will be alone in your grave. There, your soul will be given back to you and the two angels, namely Munkar and Nakir, will enter your grave to examine and interrogate you. The passage which we recited to you now is indeed food for thought. It reminds us of our eventual fate, even if we were to live for over 100 years, because death is decreed for every living thing. Death, however, is not the end of existence, especially of the human soul. It is the path to barzakh, or the intermediary period in afterlife, before resurrection of the physical body on the Day of Judgment or the Final Fate. In other words, It is the passage traversed by all, and could be called the bridge to either the eternal bliss of paradise or the eternal damnation of hell. That is the reason the two angels interrogate every person immediately after death. Barzakh, of course, has its own state of prosperity and perfidy. The all-merciful God has made it a period of grace for mankind, where rewards could be increased, faults could be forgiven or commuted, depending on the good works a person may have left behind, or anything good done on his life, behalf by offspring and friends. These words of certitude were spoken by a person who, in a matter of a few hours, had seen his brothers, uncles, cousins, friends, and finally father gloriously court death in armed combat with the forces of evil, rather than give it to the illegal demands of an illegitimate regime. The reason he himself did not meet death on the day of Ashura, 61 AH, was because of the fact he was severely sick and bedridden, and thus unable to enter the battlefield for armed jihad. Divine providence had, however, kept him for another kind of jihad, which he so admirably performed that to this day he is known as Zainul Abidin, or Ornament of the Sincere Worshippers of the One and Only God. Born in the year 38 AH in Medina to the virtuous lady Princess Shah Banu of Persia, that is Iran, and named Ali by his father, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in honor of his own father, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, he was a youth of 23 years on the fateful day of Ashura in Karbala, when almost all male members of the Prophet's household were massacred by the bloodthirsty Umayyad hordes. On the equally tragic evening of 10th of Muharram, 61 AH, he was taken prisoner by the Umayyad army, along with his wife, small son, sisters, young cousins, and aunts, including Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, the indomitable granddaughter of the Prophet of Islam. On the day following the blood-curdling tragedy, he had a brush with death when it seemed his soul would depart from his body. As he motionlessly watched the dismembered and unburied corpse of his father, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, but could not do anything since he was bound with chains and fetters. He lamented his helplessness to his aunt, who soothed and consoled him, for he was chosen by God for carrying the battle to the enemy camp. Thus started a novel way of jihad for Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, that would soon rock the court of the tyrant Yazid in Damascus, where his sermons before audiences, which included the Byzantine Christian ambassador, unnerved the self-styled caliph and made him release the Ahlul Bayt from bondage in the Syrian capital. For 34 years, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, as the fourth infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, held aloft the torch of guidance. As caliphs rose and fell in Damascus, While in Hejaz, the impostor Abdullah ibn Zubayr made life torturous for the Prophet's household for 10 long years, from 63 AH to 73 AH, even once attempting to burn alive all male members of the Hashemite clan. His supplications in the divine court and his munajat, or whispered prayers, are indeed a treasure trove of wisdom that strengthens faith through proper cognizance of God Almighty and His infinite mercy, as well as matters pertaining to the wonders of creation, such as the weight of light, which were unthinkable those days and which modern science is beginning to discover in our own times with the help of technology and electronic gadgets. The fourth Imam was, however, no ascetic, and when the regime in Damascus was helpless in the face of pressures from the Byzantine Empire regarding supply of coins that were stamped with emblems of the Christian creed, he sent his son and eventual successor, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, to Syria to give the necessary advice and make arrangements for setting up of the first ever mint in the Islamic realm, thus saving the faith of the Muslims and the drain of the bullion. In 95 AH, the survivor of the tragedy of Karbala was eventually martyred through poisoning by the wretch Walid ibn Abdul Malik, who masqueraded as Caliph in Damascus. The fourth Imam left the mortal world, but not before ensuring that the pure and pristine legacy of the Prophet passed to his son, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, and after him to his grandson, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, who was 12 years old at the time of death of his grandfather. He was laid to rest in the sacred Jannatul Baqi cemetery in the holy Medina, besides his uncle and father-in-law, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him. Today, the Wahhabi heretics may have desecrated and destroyed his tomb, along with that of his son, grandson, and uncle, but they have utterly failed in distracting people from the glorious teachings of the Ahlul Bayt on how to live a life of faith and die with dignity for earning the bliss of the hereafter. No wonder. Among the immortal legacies of the fourth Imam is the prayer supplication manual, Sahifatul Sajjadiyya, and the treatise on rights, titled Rasalatul Huquq, which modern scholars consider more perfect than the UN Charter of Human Rights, since it embodies each and every right, including the right of our own bodily organs upon ourselves. Before bidding you farewell, we present you a passage from this remarkable work on the proper use of our own tongue, which is vital for a speech. The right of the tongue is that you consider it too noble for obscenity. Accustom it to good. Refrain from any meddling in which there is nothing to be gained. Express kindness to the people and speak well concerning them.
We give people. freedom of speech.
The freedom of speech has been fought for hundreds of years in the United States, but now many are afraid it is only an illusion in American universities. Every year, some academic professors and faculty members are denied their tenure or flat out lose their jobs for expressing views which threaten a powerful entity in the U.S. So does freedom of speech even exist in America?
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Now, if you watched the previous episodes of our show, you'll know that we discuss social, political, and economic matters of the United States and also the country's relations and activities throughout the world. On this episode, we'll speak about the freedom of speech and how many faculty members in the U.S. universities have lost their jobs for expressing views and opinions. Please stay tuned.
We won't back down!
Stop the witch hunt!
Stand here now!
We will resist!
We won't back down!
Stop the witch hunt!
Stand here now!
We won't back down!
Students all around the world go to universities to gain knowledge and expertise. Universities are where new ideas are heard and debated. University students do not appreciate being told what views they are permitted to hold and what views are not allowed. The same, of course, is true for professors and lecturers.
Freedom of speech is another slogan we hear repeated time and again in America. Numerous intellectuals and faculty members of universities have been harassed, coerced, and have oftentimes lost their jobs for expressing views and activism. We're now joined by Don DeBar, activist, commentator, and radio host and journalist at CPR News, and asked him about the situation of freedom of speech in the United States, and especially in U.S. universities.
The state of freedom of speech in the United States now is about where it was rumored to be, alleged to be, in the Soviet Union in perhaps 1952, 1953, when Stalin was still alive.
Recently, higher education institutions have denied academic tenure to prominent intellectuals like Cornel West at Harvard University. He is one of America's most prominent African-American scholars and an outspoken progressive activist. Cornel West accused Harvard University of intellectual and spiritual bankruptcy of deep depths.
You've suggested that, Professor West, that you believe some of the reasons that you were denied tenure were your support for Palestinian rights as well as for Senator Bernie Sanders. Can you elaborate on both?
Well, I argued to myself it could either be age, when I'm giving the Gifford lectures, kind of Nobel Prize version of philosophical lectures, so someone in Scotland feels that I still have something to say. So it couldn't be age. It couldn't be academics because I'd published 20-some books. I was a university professor at Harvard, university professor at Princeton. I got tenure at Yale 37 years ago, so it's a joke. It's just ludicrous and ridiculous that they would be so hesitant to allow for a tenure process to go forth. So I figured it had to be political. And the most taboo issue on U.S. campuses these days in many instances has to do with the vicious Israeli occupation of precious Palestinians.
The 68-year-old scholar suggested in his resignation letter that politics was the main reason Harvard University denied him tenure, citing his support for the Palestinian cause.
Professor West, of course, he had public disputes with the sacred cow at the time, the CEO of Harvard University, Larry Summers. Now, Larry Summers, philosophically, you can make deductions about from his resume. CEO of the World Bank, a high administration official of Bill Clinton's administration. He's one of the people that's either close to the actual people who run things or one of them that actually run things. And so if you have people that are criticizing a society that commits murder on a daily basis around the world, that has poverty within the wealthiest nation in the world, to the extent the United States does, which is an embarrassment to the rest of the civilized, or I should say to the civilized world, then you also are going to be going hat in hand for tenure.
In April of 2021, Nicole Hannah-Jones, who won a 2020 Pulitzer Prize for her groundbreaking 1619 project for the New York Times Magazine, was denied a tenured position at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill after the university's Board of Trustees took the highly unusual step of failing to approve the journalism department's recommendations.
Protest today after a professor in the UNC Journalism Department is offered a teaching contract without tenure. Nicole Hannah-Jones created the New York Times 1619 Project. It reframes the country's history around slavery and discusses contributions of African Americans. The university chancellor and the chair of the Board of Trustees, however, are defending their move. Both say that the tenure process was followed in this case, but when it was time for a vote, Hannah-Jones' application did not include a tenure option.
One of the people who raised objections to her was UNC megadonor Walter E. Hussman Jr., after whom the university's Hussman School of Journalism and Media was named. He had donated over $25 million to that institution. Our next guest is author and attorney Michael Springman. Now, Mr. Springman, who are behind-the-scenes players which put pressure on these universities to silence their opposition or those who threatened their interests?
Well, it's a variety of organizations. There's the United States government, which shut down on two occasions the online newspaper American Herald Tribune. There are the rich donors that pressure universities to suppress freedom of speech if it's critical of Israel or any other sort of ism or attitude or country. Then there's B'nai B'rith and the Anti-Defamation League. They put pressure overtly and covertly on donors and people in the university management.
Walter Hussman Jr. objected to Nicole Hannah-Jones' assertion in her 1619 Project essay that American colonists waged a revolutionary war to preserve slavery. He also took issue with her statement that blacks, for the most part, fought back alone, against discrimination, against violence and subjugation.
We're investing in Carolina and journalism because it's a very important time in America. Americans are beginning to realize they need to trust a trusted source of professional journalism, and we need to renew the values and standards and practices that have stood the test of time in journalism to renew that trust with the American people.
Walter Hussman is a graduate of this school. He is one of us. He is a Tar Heel. This naming gift means that we will have an endowment, $25 million to build for the future.
After protests and objections by university faculty and students alike, and the threat of legal action by Nicole Hannah-Jones' lawyers, the university finally offered her tenure at the end of June, after which Nicole Hannah-Jones refused the offer and joined Howard University instead.
Well, until very recently, my expectation was that I would remain at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill as well. As I've said, this is my alma mater. I wasn't seeking to go into academia. It was this particular job at this particular place that I wanted to go and give back to the university that helped me build the career that I've built. But things really shifted after the story went public. A couple of things. I didn't have any idea the extent to which political interference had led to my being denied the tenure that every other Knight professor before me had achieved.
Over the years, faculty from different universities have been harassed, denied tenure, or even fired from their positions under a different pretext, but ultimately because they have strong views which oppose the official beliefs of the United States. Universities are often funded by wealthy institutions or individuals which will deny their donations if the university does not fire a certain faculty member who's expressed views against them or their beliefs.
In essence, an empire, an imperial structure, late stage or late stage, however you want to characterize it, capitalist colonialism, imperialism, that has control of more than half of the population and most of the resources of the world, with about 800 military bases of the United States and its allies placed around the world to maintain that control, a variety of dictatorships of that class, essentially, running most of the countries of the world as agents, you know, as compradors, as, you know, we're seeing now the people who are trying to run out of Afghanistan, for example, even the low-level and mid-level officials. This structure exists all over the world.
In another example, the trustees of the University of Illinois voted in 2014 to block the appointment of Stephen Salata, a Palestinian-American professor who had been offered a tenured position in 2013. However, following a campaign by pro-Israel students, faculty members and donors contended that his Twitter comments about the bombardment of the Gaza Strip by the Israeli military were anti-Semitic.
We end today's show with professor and author Stephen Salata. Last year, his job offer for a tenured position for the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign was withdrawn after he posted tweets harshly critical of the 2014 Israeli assault on Gaza. The school had come under pressure from donors, from students, parents, and alumni critical of Salida's views, with some threatening to withdraw financial support. The move was criticized both in and outside of the school, with administrators accused of political censorship.
Mr. Salata had been scheduled to teach two classes in the university's American Indian Studies department that fall before supporters of Israel drew attention to his Twitter feed, where he had expressed outrage over Israel's Gaza offensive.
Well, people who are outspoken critics of Israel and the United States lose their jobs, are sidelined, they're unable to publish. I've spoken with a well-known Arab journalist, and she's told me any number of times that the extremist organizations and the establishment all work together and are well-funded, but if you try to provide the correct attitude and an explanation of what's really happening in the world, you're simply shunted off to the side, and nobody has any money to pay you to live on while you're writing these articles critical of the establishment and Israel.
Salata had written a tweet in 2014 that read, "The logic of anti-Semitism deployed by Zionists, if applied in principle, would make pretty much everybody not a sociopath anti-Semitic."
Salata later went to the American University of Beirut, in which he taught for a year. Then U.S. senators and university donors pressured the university president into canceling his appointment.
I was at Virginia Tech as a tenured English professor. I was offered the job at the University of Illinois. I subsequently signed a contract that the University of Illinois then countersigned, and everything was set up for me to move and begin my position. Within around a week of my physical move from Virginia to Illinois, I received a termination letter out of nowhere from the chancellor, which just sort of threw my life into disarray. I all of a sudden didn't have an income and health insurance or a place to live. We had to cancel the contract.
Your whole family was moving.
Yeah, my whole family was moving. And so we ended up living with my parents, and then, you know, after around a year of sort of going to different places around the country and speaking about the situation, I was offered a one-year visiting professorship at the American University of Beirut, and that's where I am now.
Stephen Salata later leaves academia, and as of 2019, since he was not hired by any other university, he became a school bus driver in suburban Washington, D.C. This brings us to the question of what are the risks of being an outspoken critic of Israel and United States' policies?
Well, let's pick the two former members of Congress who were the most outspoken on that. Cynthia McKinney, ex-Representative Cynthia McKinney, the ex being the relevant part, and Dennis Kucinich, again, ex-Representative Dennis Kucinich. In each case, they had spoken out. In fact, Cynthia McKinney informed the world that AIPAC had brought or some other agent of the State of Israel to her as a member of Congress a statement to sign pledging, you know, that we will look out for and make sure Israel, our best friend, gets whatever it needs from the U.S. Congress. She refused to sign it because she considered it a violation of her oath of office and perhaps of some corruption statutes also. She spoke out loud about it. And she was painted as an anti-Semite, as a lunatic. She was set up by the Capitol Police.
Now, the right to freedom of speech was recognized in the U.S. Bill of Rights back in 1791. In the U.S., freedom of speech and constitutional limits to it have been defined and practiced by rulings from the Supreme Court.
The IWW trial was the largest mass trial in the history of the United States. 101 defendants, 101 convictions. Everybody who went to trial was convicted. Those who did not evade U.S. jurisdiction went to prison for it. What was it they went to prison for? Sedition. What was the sedition? Telling draft-age men in the United States not to go to World War I. That's it. The land of free speech.
Even though on paper you are supposed to have the right to freedom of speech, in practice there are things you're just not supposed to say.
I just named some. The State of Israel as the, you know, Holy Ghost of the American people or whatever. That's one. You can't challenge that role. The U.S. military and American imperialism in general.
Outspoken activist and professor of the University of Colorado Boulder from 1990 through 2007, Ward Churchill was fired from his university post after his essay written in the wake of the September 11 attacks gained attention years later. He's dubbed by dominant corporate U.S. media as hater of America.
So we have no moral high ground when it comes to America versus ISIS.
I've seen American moral high ground at work in Southeast Asia, thank you very much. And the answer to that would be an absolute no.
Churchill had argued the September 11 attacks were a natural and unavoidable consequence of unlawful U.S. foreign policy over the latter half of the 20th century. The essay is known for Churchill's use of the phrase Little Eichmanns, a comparison to the Nazi bureaucrat to describe the technocratic corps working at the World Trade Center in New York.
Every Palestinian child shot in the head for throwing a rock in the Intifada is being shot with munitions provided by the United States. The munitions are fired from a rifle provided by the United States. When they look up and see those helicopters that are taking out apartment blocks because they suspect somebody they don't like is in there, collateral damage ensues. The helicopter and the missile are provided by the taxpayers of the United States, and to see the problem is not just that the material, the monetary support, and the political endorsements provided by the government of the United States, but there's this overwhelming embrace of the policy by the general citizenry of the United States.
In March of 2005, because the university couldn't go after the professor for expressing his views in an essay, they began investigating allegations that Churchill had engaged in research misconduct, and in 2006, they reported that indeed he had engaged in such misconduct.
In terms of the role of the universities in the United States, their funding stream shifted from private donations and federal grant money starting in the really post-war period, post-World War II period, to where the military and the intelligence services and large corporations became the primary sources of their funding, even dwarfing tuition as a source, for example.
Churchill was fired on 24th of July 2007, despite having tenure. He then filed a lawsuit against the University of Colorado for unlawful termination of employment. And a Denver jury found that Churchill was indeed unjustly fired by the university, awarding him just $1 in damages in 2009.
A jury says the University of Colorado was wrong to fire Professor Ward Churchill. That verdict came after just more than a day of deliberations. CBS 4's Carlin Tilley is outside the court in downtown Denver. Carlin, we still don't know, though, if Churchill will indeed get the job back.
That was the one verdict not delivered today, but there were three verdicts that were delivered today. One, were Ward Churchill's freedom of speech rights violated, and did the university act inappropriately? Yes. Was Ward Churchill wrongfully fired? Yes. Did the university have enough reason to fire Churchill otherwise? The answer to that was no. Churchill's lawyers patted him on the back as the verdict was read. The jury only awarded him $1 in damages, but Churchill says he never asked for money. He asked for justice and for his job back.
Later that year, a district court judge vacated the monetary award and declined Churchill's request to order his reinstatement, deciding that the university has quasi-judicial immunity. Churchill appealed that decision, and the Court of Appeals upheld the lower court's ruling in favor of the university. And then in 2013, the Supreme Court outright declined to even hear the case.
I see happening here is the government, in collusion with the corporate media, is creating a lynch mob. They're advocating a lynch mob to lynch Ward. Now, the danger in that, and it's my belief that the government of the state of Colorado, legislature and governor, are in lockstep with the corporate media to incite some nut to kill him.
Now, freedom in the United States is a huge sham. Freedom might be provided in insignificant and trivial areas, while it is taken away where it counts most by whatever means necessary.
Well, U.S. universities are in the forefront of thought control and of blocking any alternative viewpoints being presented if it's an unpopular one. Fordham University, a couple of years ago, refused to permit Palestinians on campus to demonstrate and to speak out against Israel. They shut them down. They canceled their demonstrations. They canceled their organization. So, and that's a good Catholic university run by the Jesuits. So it's a situation where the universities simply are working hand in glove with the extremists and the people who want to prevent you from thinking.
I'm a DePaul student as well, and I'm a fan of Finkelstein. But I think that at the simplest level, this is about, as a student, we should be able to learn what we want to learn. And we're essentially, this is an academic voice that's being silenced.
Norman Finkelstein, outspoken activist and critic of Israel and supporter of Palestinian rights, was denied tenure at DePaul University after a feud with Alan Dershowitz on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Finkelstein had been teaching political science at DePaul for over 6 years.
All this process of voting for the tenure is really a charade, because the ultimate power here is the president.
This is just the tip of the iceberg. For many years, activists, faculty members, and intellectuals have been silenced forcefully by various powerful elite groups, individuals, and officials in the country.
Well, in the United States, freedom of expression is failing. It's obsessed with people being right and you're being wrong. And as far as the universities go, it's pretty much the same. They seem to be controlled by extremist groups and organizations with lots of money to shut down any kind of opposition to the established order of things.
One should not forget that the professors who are fired or denied tenure are also being made examples. By looking at these examples, other faculty members who are looking to advance their careers in the academia will self-censor, and they refrain from saying something controversial so as not to disrupt their tenure track.
Well, that was our show this week, everyone. Thank you. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us next week on another episode of We the People. Goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BATR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.